Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Well, I've been on the road. I just did a short retreat with my friends Joseph Goldstein and Dan Harris, where we did some meditation but also recorded some conversations. Those will eventually be available over at Waking Up, and I am still traveling, so I'll not be doing a long housekeeping here. I am resisting the tractor beam pull of politics at the moment. No doubt it will soon be all-encompassing. But today I am focused on artificial intelligence and its attendant risks and the growing effort to regulate it, which remains controversial. Today I'm speaking with Scott Weiner and Yoshua Bengio. Scott is a member of the California State Senate, and he has introduced a bill, SB 1047, which aims to reduce the risks of the frontier models of AI, models bigger than any which currently exist. And if it passes, it will be an important piece of legislation. The bill has already passed the California Senate, and it's approaching an assembly floor vote later this month. And joining Scott is Yoshua Bengio, who's one of the leading lights of artificial intelligence. He's known for breakthroughs in deep learning and other relevant technology. He won the Turing Award in 2018, which has been described as the Nobel Prize for computer science, and he's a full professor at the University of Montreal. He's also a fellow of the Royal Society of London and Canada, a Knight of the Legion of Honor of France, and has other distinctions too numerous to name here. One thing he is not is someone who is uninformed about the current state of the technology, as well as the prospects of making surprising progress toward artificial general intelligence. So we talk about AI risk, the strange assumptions of certain people, some of whom I've spoken with on this podcast, who seem to think there's really no serious risk to worry about, and who view any concept of regulation as premature and economically injurious. Anyway, fascinating topic. All too consequential. And now I bring you Scott Weiner and Yoshua Bengio. I am here with Scott Weiner and Yoshua Bengio. Scott, Yoshua, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
So I will have introduced you properly in my housekeeping, but perhaps you can each tell me, I'll start with you, Scott, how have you come to focus on the issue of AI safety, which is what we're going to talk about.
Sure. And again, thanks for having us today and for talking about this issue. So I have the great honor and privilege of representing the great city of San Francisco, which is really the beating heart of AI innovation, no offense to other parts of the world. And I'm really proud of that. And so I am, you know, immersed in the tech world in terms of just people who are around me in the community, ranging from high-level executives at large tech companies to startup founders to just frontline technologists, academics, investors, just the entire gamut. And about a year and a half or so ago, folks in the community in the AI space started talking to me about the issue of the safety of large language models, and started looking into it more, had a series of dinners and salons and meetings, started reaching out to a number of people and realized that this was an area that we should be addressing. And that's how it all started.
Nice. Nice. Yoshua?
Yeah. After 4 decades of research in AI and contributing to the exciting advances in deep learning that I've produced generative AI as we see it today, I came to realize with the advent of ChatGPT that things were moving a lot faster than I and almost everyone in the field anticipated. And I started thinking about what this could mean for humans, for society, for democracy, if we continued on that trajectory towards human level or AGI. And I thought, well, society is not prepared for that. And we need to start thinking right now about mitigating the risks.
We're going to talk about a bill that is in the process of finding its way toward possibly becoming law, SB 1047. But before we jump into the details of regulating AI and why we might want to do that and how, Joshua, I thought you and I were talking offline about kind of where you stand on this continuum of concern. I mean, you're one of the leaders in this field, and I've spoken to many people, you know, both inside the field and, you know, at some part of its periphery, who have focused on this question of AI safety. And there's a wide range of attitudes here. And, you know, I would say on the far side of freaked out, you have someone like Eliezer Yudkowsky, who's been on the podcast before. Also, someone like Nick Bostrom, whose book Superintelligence was very influential, and I've spoken to him as well. And then on the far side of insouciant and, to my eye, utterly in denial that there's any possible downside here, you have people like Rodney Brooks, the roboticist, and Mark Andreessen, the venture capitalist. Rodney hasn't actually been on the podcast, but I debated him at an event, and Mark has been here. And then in the middle, you have someone like, or not quite in the middle, but at a place where that really has always struck me as very rational and still worried, is someone like Stuart Russell, the computer scientist at Berkeley. So I'm wondering, can you locate yourself on this continuum, or are you in some other spot in the space of all possible attitudes?
So in a way, I'm looking at this scene, and no one can honestly say what scenario is going to unfold. The scientists among themselves disagree, but there are enough people who believe that the risk is potentially catastrophic and could be just a few years, but it could also equally be decades. We don't know. So there's enough uncertainty and enough like potential level of harm that the rational thing to do is to consider all of these scenarios and then act accordingly, according to the precautionary principle. In other words, well, we need to be ready in case it happens in, so, I don't know, 2030, that we get human level or worse, I mean, even superhuman. And we need to be prepared in case we don't handle it well and companies haven't found a way to make sure AI cannot be misused by bad actors in catastrophic ways, or companies haven't figured out how to control an AI so that it doesn't turn against humans. So all of these catastrophic possibilities, right now we don't have the answers. And so the sort of rational thing to do here is to work to mitigate those risks. So that means understanding those risks better rather than denying them, which is not going to help to find solutions, and putting in place the right protection for the public in case these potentially catastrophic things are, you know, more dangerous or shorter term than many people might expect.
Yeah.
So I'm really in the agnostic camp, but rational, meaning we have to actually do things in order to avoid bad scenarios.
Right. And I would you acknowledge that there are two, broadly speaking, two levels of risk here? There's the near-term risk of really that I think we see already, even with so-called narrow AI, where it's just the human misuse of increasingly powerful tools, whether it's just to derange our politics with misinformation or, you know, cyber warfare or, you know, any other malicious use of increasingly powerful AI. And then we tip over at some point, provided we just continue to make progress, into what you seem to be referencing, which is more often thought of as the problem of misaligned AI, you know, the so-called alignment problem, where we could build something that is truly general in intelligence and more powerful than ourselves, you know, cognitively, and yet we could build it in such a way whereas it would be unaligned with our, you know, ongoing happy cohabitation with it.
Yes, there are currently no defensible scientific arguments that neither of these are possible. So and I want to make a little correction to the sort of risks that you describe, because even if we find a way to create AI that is controllable, aligned, and so on, it could still become dangerous in the wrong hands.
Yeah.
First of all, these safety protections, if you control like the system, you just remove those safety protections so that the AI will do bad things for you, right? Because you have to understand how AI works. AI is about how to achieve goals or how to respond to queries using knowledge and reasoning. But really, who decides on the goals? That normally is the user. And if we have safety protections, maybe we can like filter goals that are not acceptable. But of course, the humans could still do bad things. So even if we go to superhuman AI, if it's in the wrong hands, we could end up with a, you know, a world dictatorship, right? And that's very bad. Maybe not as bad as, you know, human extinction, but it's very, very bad. Clearly, we want to make sure we don't let anything close to that happen.
Hmm. Yashua, one more question for you, and then I'll pivot to the bill itself. But what do you make of people who have a similar degree of knowledge to your own, right? People who are in the field, out of whom you get more or less nothing but happy talk and dismissals about these concerns. I mean, they just, there are people like, perhaps I'm not being entirely fair to everyone here, but, you know, someone like Jan LeCun or even Jeffrey Hinton, right? I mean, he's had an epiphany, which has caused him to be quite yes. worried and voluble on this topic in public. But for the longest time, you know, here we have the, you know, one of the true patriarchs of the field kind of moving along and making progress and not seeming to anticipate that he might wake up one day and realize, well, wait a minute, we're on course to build something smarter than we are. This entails the possibility of risk. How is it that there's a diversity of opinion among well-informed people that there are any significant risks at all to worry about?
So it's interesting that you're talking about Jeff Hinton and Jan LeCun because the three of us are good friends.
Mm.
And of course, Jan and I mean, Jeff and I kind of agree and Jan doesn't about the risks. So Jeff and I independently shifted our views, like really pivoted around January or February 23, a few months after ChatGPT became available. And our views before that were that, oh, human level intelligence is something so far into the future that, you know, we could reap benefits of AI well before we got there. But what happened with ChatGPT is realized that, well, things are moving a lot faster than we thought. We now have machines that essentially pass what is called the Turing test. In other words, they master language as well as humans. They can pass for humans in a dialogue. That's what the Turing test is. And so our timeline suddenly shifted down to anything from a few years to a few decades, whereas previously we thought it would be like centuries or decades. So that's really the main reason we shifted. So why is it that?
So the crucial variable was the change in expectation around the time horizon.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And in fact, if you dig and try to understand why most scientists disagree on the risk, it's because they disagree on the timeline. But my position is we don't know what the timeline is.
Right.
Okay, but you also asked me about like, why is it Jan LeCun, who is like basically at the same level of proficiency in the field as Jeff and I, why is it that he continues to think that we shouldn't worry about risks? It's an interesting question. I think I wrote about it in my blog. By the way, my latest blog entry goes through pretty much all of the criticisms I've read about, you know, taking risks seriously and rationally trying to explain, you know, why, because of our uncertainty, the scientific, you know, lack of knowledge, we really need to pay attention. But I think for many people, there's all kinds of psychological biases going on. Imagine you've been working on something all your life and suddenly somebody tells you that it actually could be bad for democracy or humanity. Well, it isn't something you really want to hear. Or if you're rich because of, you know, working in a field that would eventually bring really dangerous things to society, well, maybe this is not something you want to hear either. So you prefer to go to something more comfortable, like the belief that it's all going to be all right. For example, Jan is saying he's agreeing actually on almost everything I'm saying. He just thinks that we'll find a solution beforehand. And so don't worry. Well, I would like that to happen, but I think we need to proactively make sure, you know, we do the right thing. We provide the right incentives to companies to do the right research and so on. So yeah, it's complicated.
Wouldn't he admit that a completely unregulated arms race among all parties is not the right system of incentives by which to find a solution?
No, he wouldn't. He thinks that it's better to let everybody have access to very powerful AI, and there will be more good AIs than bad AIs. But that isn't rational either. You know, in a conflict situation, you have attackers and defenders. And depending on the attack threat, It could be that there's an advantage to the attacker, or there could be an advantage to the defender. Mm. In the case of AI, it depends on which technology the AI, you know, is used for to attack, say, democracies. An example is cyber attacks. Cyber attacks, it's hard for the defender because you have to plug all the holes, whereas the attacker just needs to find one hole. Or bioweapons, like, you know, if an attacker uses AI to design a bioweapon, you know, the attacker can work for months to design the bioweapon, and then they release it in many places in the world, and then people start dying, and it's going to take months at least to find a cure, during which people are dying, right? So it's not symmetrical. It's not because you have more, like, good people controlling AIs than bad ones that the world is protected. It just doesn't work like this.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's dive into the possibilities of controlling the chaos. Scott, what is this bill that has various technologists worried?
Yeah, so Senate Bill 1047 has a fairly basic premise that if you are training and releasing an incredibly powerful model, which we define as exceeding 10 to the 26th flop, we've also added in that you've spent at least $100 million in training the model, and that'll go up with inflation, that if you are training and releasing a model of that scale, of that magnitude, of that power, perform reasonable safety evaluations ahead of time. And if your safety evaluations show a significant risk of catastrophic harm, take reasonable steps to mitigate the risk. This is not about eliminating risk. Life is about risk. It's about trying to get ahead of the risk instead of saying, well, let's wait and see. And after something catastrophic happens, then we'll figure it out. That's sort of the human way of things at times. Let's get ahead of it. And what's interesting here is that all of the large labs have already committed to doing this testing. They have, all of their CEOs have gone to the White House, to Congress, most recently to Seoul, South Korea, and have sworn up and down that they either are doing or they will be doing this safety testing. And the bill doesn't micromanage what the safety testing will be. It provides flexibility. It's light touch. But now we have people coming forward and saying, oh, wait, we know we committed to it, or they committed to it, but, you know, don't actually require it. And that doesn't make sense to me. And so that's the heart of the bill. There are some other aspects that if a model is still in your possession, you have to be able to shut it down, and a few things like that.
And maybe I can make a connection here between that answer and the previous question. So there are people, as you said, Sam, who don't believe that there is any risk. And of course, if we only went by, you know, their choices, they wouldn't do the right thing in terms of safety. So it's not enough to have these commitments. We need to make sure that everyone actually does it. And that is why you need laws. Voluntary commitments are great, and they're already mostly committing, you know, already committed, but we need to make sure it actually happens.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And we've seen in a lot of industries that voluntary commitments only get you so far. And even if all of the current leadership of the labs are fully and deeply committed to doing this, and I take them at their word and that they're acting in good faith, we have no idea who's going to be running these labs or other labs that don't exist yet 2, 3, 5 years from now, and what the pressures are going to be. Mm-hmm. The other thing I just want to add, in this bill, we've had some critics of the bill that have really engaged with us in good faith, and we're so appreciative of that. There are other critics who there's a lot of whataboutism, and one of them is, well, what about other risks and other technology that causes risk? Okay, yes, there are other technology that could cause risk, but we're focused on this very real and tangible potential risk. And the other argument that they sometimes make, I really find this a little bit offensive, dismissing anyone who raises any question or concern about safety, saying you're a doomer, you're a doomer, you're part of a cult, you know this is a cult-like behavior, and you're a doomer, and just making you're an extremist. And by the way, none of these risks are real. It's all science fiction. It's all made up. And my response to them is, well, first of all, not everyone's a doomer just because you care about safety or want to maybe take some action around safety. But if you really believe that these risks are fabricated, made up, just pure science fiction, then why are you concerned about the bill? Because if the risks are really fake, then if you really believe that, then you should also believe that the bill won't cover anything, because none of these harms will ever happen and it's all science fiction. And so the fact that they are fighting so hard against the bill, led by A16, mm-hmm. the fact that they're fighting so hard against it sort of really contradicts their claim that they believe that these risks are science fiction.
So I can imagine that someone over at Andreessen Horowitz would say that, first of all, it's going to pose an economic and legal burden to any company in this business, and there's going to be capital flight out of California. I mean, people will just do this work elsewhere because California has become an even more hostile place for business now. And so is there something about, I mean, if we were going to give a charitable gloss of their fears, what's the worst case scenario from their point of view that is actually honestly engaging with what you intend, right? So like what kind of lawsuits could bedevil a company that produces an AI that does something bad? What kind of liability are you trying to expose these companies to? And just, you know, how expensive is it in time or resources to do the kind of safety testing you envision, Joshua?
Well, they're already doing it. I mean, at least many of them are, since they committed to the Biden executive order, and they have been doing these tests since then, or even before in some cases. And it's not hugely expensive. So in terms of the liability, I think if they do sort of reasonable tests that, you know, one would expect from somebody who knows about the state of the art, then they shouldn't worry too much about liability.
Well, so actually, before we get to liability seems to me to be very hard to characterize in advance. I can understand worrying about that. But just on the safety testing, have any of these companies that have agreed to persist in testing disclosed, you know, what percent of their budget is getting absorbed by AI safety concerns? I mean, are we talking about a 5% spend or a 40% spend, or what is it? Do we know?
We think it's very small, especially in the, it's not, I think it's more like the not less than 5%. It's a few percentage points. And so we think it's about 2-3% as far as we can tell.
Okay.
And so it's, you know, and again, this is the large labs. It's when you're spending at least $100 million to train. This is not about startups. I understand there are startups that have concerns because they want to make sure they have access to Llama and other open source models. But in terms of who's going to have to comply with this, it's not startups. It is large labs that are spending massive amounts of money to train these models. And they are absolutely able to do it. And they have all said that they either are doing it or are committing to do it. So, you know, it's really interesting to me that you have a large lab saying that they're committing to doing it or already doing it. And then you have some investors, most notably A16, saying, oh, it's all made up. The safety testing is not real. It's impossible. And so it's like, okay, well, which is it? And if they say that they're already doing it.
Okay, so let's say they do all of this good faith safety testing, and yet safety testing is not perfect. And one of these models, let's say it's ChatGPT-5, gets used to do something nefarious. You know, somebody weaponizes it against our energy grid, and it just turns out the lights in half of America, say. And when all the costs of that power outage are tallied, it's plausible that would run to the tens of billions of dollars, and there'd be many deaths, right? I mean, what are the consequences of turning out the lights in a hospital, or in every hospital in every major city in half of America for 48 hours? Somebody's going to die, right? So what are you imagining on the liability front? Is that all of that trickle up to Sam Altman in his house in Napa drinking white wine on a summer afternoon? What are we picturing here?
Yeah. So, well, under this bill, if they've done what the bill requires, which is to perform the safety evaluations and so forth. If they do that, then they're not liable under this bill. Again, it's not about eliminating risk. So companies, labs can protect themselves from the very focused liability under this bill. This bill, which first of all, is not dependent on training or releasing the model in California or being physically located in California, which is why this whole claim that labs are going to, or startups are going to leave California. If you are training and releasing your model from Miami or from Omaha, Nebraska, as long if you are doing business in California, which they all will be, it's the fifth largest economy in the world, it's the epicenter of the technology sector, unless you're going to not do business in California, which I'm highly doubtful of, you are covered by the bill. And only the attorney general can file a lawsuit. And it's only if you have not complied with the bill and one of these huge harms happens. One thing that the opponents of the bill continue to like just refuse to acknowledge is that there is liability today, much broader than what is created by SB 1047. If you release a model, even a smaller one that you spent, you know, $500,000 or $1 million on, you release that model, and then that model somehow contributes to a much smaller harm than what we're talking about here, burning down someone's house, doing something, you know, something that harms someone, that person can sue you today under just regular tort liability law in California, and I assume in all 50 states. They can sue you today. That liability will be disputed and litigated. And I'm sure in the coming years, the courts are going to spend a lot of time sculpting what the contours of liability is for artificial intelligence. But that liability risk, that litigation risk exists today in a much broader way than what SB 1047 provides. And that's why the reaction to the liability aspect of this bill, I think, is overstated. And then on top of that, they keep spreading misinformation that model developers are going to go to prison if your model contributes to harm, which is completely false and made up.
Interesting. So why do this at the state level? You know, as you've indicated, there's already movement at the federal level. I mean, that the Biden administration has made similar noises about this. Why shouldn't this just be a federal effort?
Well, in an ideal world, it would be a federal effort. And I would love for Congress to pass a strong AI safety law. I would also love for Congress to pass a federal data privacy law, which it has never done. I would also love Congress to pass a strong net neutrality law, which it has never done. And so as a result, I authored California's net neutrality law 6 years ago, and we also passed in California a data privacy law. I would love for all of that to be federal, but Congress, with the exception of banning TikTok, has not passed a significant piece of technology legislation since the 1990s. That may change soon with this child protection social media law, we'll see. But Congress has a what can only be described as a poor record of trying to regulate the technology sector. So yes, it would be great for Congress to do it. I'm not holding my breath. The Biden executive order, I like it. I applaud it. It's an executive order. It does not have the force of law. And the Republican platform has stated, Donald Trump's platform states that that executive order will be revoked on day one if Donald Trump is elected president, God forbid.
Does this have any effect on open source AI, or are you just imagining targeting the largest companies that are doing closed source work?
The bill does not distinguish between open source and closed source. They're both covered equally by the bill. We have made some amendments to the bill in response to feedback from the open source community. One change that we made was to make it crystal clear that if a model is no longer in your possession, you're not responsible to be able to shut it down. Because that was some feedback we had received, that if it's been open sourced and you no longer have it, you are not able to shut it down. So we made that change. We also made some changes around clarifying when a model, say that is open source, is no longer a derivative model. In other words, there's enough changes or fine-tuning to the model that it effectively becomes a new model at a certain point, and that the original developer is no longer responsible once someone else has changed the model sufficiently, that that changer, the person fine-tuning, would then become effectively the person responsible under the law.
I'd like to add something about open source. Mm-hmm. So you have to remember there's this threshold which can be adapted in the future, the cost or the size of these models. And most of the open source that is happening in academia and startups that are generated by these companies or these universities, they're much smaller because they don't have $100 million to train their system. And so all of that open source activity can continue and not be affected by SB 1047.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you say it was 10 to the 23rd, 10 to the 26th?
26.
That's floating point operations per second. Is that the measure?
Yes. Okay. Floating or integer.
So how big is that in relation to the current biggest model? So ChatGPT 4.0?
It's above all of the existing ones.
Okay. So everything that we currently have, the best LLMs, haven't yet met the threshold that would invoke.
Yeah. This so this regulation is only for the future models that at least we don't know about yet. And there's a good reason for that, because the models that harbor the most risks are the ones that haven't been, you know, played with, haven't been made available. So there's a lot more unknowns. So it does make sense to focus on the sort of frontier systems when you're thinking about risks.
When you're thinking about the frontier, doesn't that play both ways in the sense that critics of this regulation, I can imagine, and certainly critics of the kinds of fears you and I and others have expressed about AGI, artificial general intelligence, would say and have said that we simply don't know enough to be rationally, you know, looking for any sort of brake to pull or any, you know, safety guidelines to enshrine into law. I mean, I'm thinking of, I think it was Andrew Ng who once said, you know, worrying about artificial general intelligence is like worrying about overpopulation on Mars, right? Like it's so far, again, this invokes the timeline, which you and many other people now think is far shorter than assumed there. But it's not just a matter of time. It's just that the architecture of the coming robot overlord may be quite different from what we're currently playing with LLMs. Is there any charitable version of that we could prop up that it's too soon for us to be drawing guidelines because we simply don't know enough?
Okay, I have several things to say about this. First of all, if we're worried about the short-term possibilities, like say 5 years or something, or 2030, then it's very likely that it's going to be something very close to what we have now. Mm. It's very unlikely that we're going to have, you know, in 3 or 5 years, something fundamentally different. What is more plausible if you look at the advances in the last decade is incremental changes that allow to, you know, get these systems to be more efficient, to reason better, and so on. And so the logical thing to do is to say, well, we know what these systems are roughly going to look like if it comes short in the short horizon. And so that gives us pretty strong things to look at in terms of safety. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the law, the bill doesn't actually prescribes any particular way of evaluating risks. It is up to the companies and, of course, the international and national standards and the academic community who are discussing and you know, trying different kinds of risk evaluations. It is up to that ecosystem to come up with better and gradually better and better ways for evaluating and mitigating the risks. That's what those tests are about. So it is great because we're basically incentivizing companies to do more homework on the safety side. Mm. And so it's going to stimulate the creation of systems that are both capable and safe.
Okay, but it's got to be faster and easier to recklessly build unsafe AI than it is to scrupulously button up your research at every step along the way so as not to be incurring, you know, these unconscionable risks, right?
So that's right. That's why you need to level the playing field with legislation.
Right. So, okay, but so the arms race is, as you know, global, right? So it's not just that Amazon is in arms race with Anthropic and both of them against Google and all three of them against Inflection, et cetera, et cetera. What about China? Does this possibly just seed the race to AGI or some kind of winner-take-all status of even imperfectly broad AI to China or to any other state actor that is less concerned about the end of the world than we are?
So I think we have to deal with both problems. We have to deal with the risks that are caused by the systems that we're creating. Hmm. And we have to make sure that we don't end up in a situation where some authoritarian government elsewhere uses AI, develops AI that is turned against democracies. So it isn't like one or the other. We have to deal with both. And 1047 is more addressing the local efforts. But I think the federal government has a responsibility with the companies to make sure that we are on a path where we can create AI that's going to be safe and that we can, you know, use that AI, for example, to protect ourselves against potentially rogue AI coming up in other countries.
Yeah. And if I can just add in there, it seems that one of China's main strategies around AI and technology is to steal it from US companies. And so, you know, that's important to keep in mind. And if we've improved the safety of these models, that'll be beneficial. I also think in terms of our authoritarian governments, China, Russia, whatever, they're not going to want to have separate sources of power in terms of increasingly powerful AI that could undermine their own control. And so that's sort of just an inherent aspect of any authoritarian government. So I don't think it's as clear as some have stated that, oh, if we act responsibly, if we act responsibly around AI, then China's just going to act irresponsibly and eclipse us. It's unclear to me that that is actually the case.
And I would add another thing about China. So I was in China a few months ago and talked to various actors, including in government and academia and business, about AI. And they are also concerned about catastrophic, you know, outcomes of misuse or loss of control. If the US, starting maybe with California, has some form of regulation to reduce the risks and, you know, make sure companies at least try to evaluate and control those risks, it'll be easier for the US to negotiate treaties with other countries in which we all agree to similar things that what California is currently proposing. So it's a virtuous cycle that we're entering once we go in that direction, because the other guys also don't want to take those risks.
Yeah. Yeah. So Scott, what has been the posture of the main players here with respect to this legislation? Not the venture capitalists, but the companies like Anthropic and OpenAI and Microsoft.
Yeah.
Have they been collaborative here, or are they adversarial? What's the dialogue like?
It's been a mix. So recently, actually, I think it was last week, Anthropic submitted a letter, a quote-unquote support if amended letter. That's one of the categories in terms of positions you can take in the California legislature. So in other words, saying, we will
support... That sounds like my wife's support for many of my bright ideas.
yes. So the letter says that Anthropic will support the bill if certain amendments are made. And so that was a breakthrough, having one of the large labs charting out a specific path to support. In terms of other companies, Meta, Google, Microsoft, OpenAI, we've met with them repeatedly. There's been some constructive engagement for sure, but Meta and Google both submitted what were either explicitly or in effect opposition letters, which also is interesting because some of the venture capitalists have said that this is a regulatory capture bill, quote unquote, and that this is something that's going to capture, you know, it's going to be regulatory capture by the large labs at the expense of startups. But of course, Meta and Google are opposing the bill because it's not a regulatory capture bill.
Right. I feel like this phrase is used a lot and many people don't understand it. Perhaps, can we define regulatory capture and why the situation you just described is sort of the reverse of the usual logic? I mean, if regulatory capture is the thing a monopolist like or an aspiring monopolist like Microsoft would want under these conditions. So
yeah, I mean, a classic case of regulatory capture would be just picture, you know, an industry of, you know, like hog slaughter, that you have the two big hog slaughter companies go to the legislature or Congress and say, set up this we want to be regulated, set up this regulatory system, and the system has the effect of making it so that only those two companies are able to actually qualify, and so everyone else is aced out. That would be a classic case of regulatory capture. That is not what's happening here. Here, only the large labs will even be subject to the regulation. Startups will not be subject to it. And so it's really, in some sense, the opposite of regulatory capture. And so I think that that is a phrase that gets thrown around a lot by people who just don't want to see regulation. And they're arguing essentially that any form of regulation is regulatory capture. So get off our lawn, let us do what we want.
Mm. Yashua, do you have a sense of how fully transparent the work of each of these main players is to all the others? I mean, do they freely share their safety-related edge cases? You know, like if OpenAI produced something that seemed objectively scary, is there a kind of a star chamber meeting among all the technologists where they would share this? Or is there just a truly badly incentivized arms race where they're, you know, everyone is treating everyone as a pure competitor and adversary?
So they have said that if one of them were to reach AGI, they would like engage in a discussion with the others to do it in an orderly fashion or something. But they're not sharing much of the details of what they're doing in terms of safety testing. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why we need legislation. We need to make sure that independent parties that represent the public can have a look at the details of the tests they've made. Because right now it's like, you know, the companies are grading their own homework and deciding, oh, our tests are good enough, we can move forward. And, you know, there's been a recent event of people leaving these companies and saying that they were not able to express their views due to all kinds of pressures. So the part of the bill that is to protect whistleblowers is also something important here to bring, you know, to reduce a bit some of the fog, in addition to their duty to have plans and to divulge those plans to the government.
Well, it's fascinating work and a fascinating moment. Is there anything about the technology or the possible regulation of it or the bill itself that we haven't touched upon that you guys think is important to talk about?
Well, I mean, I just want to say, just big picture, I'm really excited about the potential benefits of artificial intelligence. You know, again, there are some of the opposition likes to paint anyone who's concerned about safety and wants to address that as a doomer or as being opposed to the technology. I think AI has so many potential benefits around, you know, healthcare, climate, and so on and so forth. And we've already seen that. But with any powerful technology, there are huge potential benefits and also potential risks. And so let's try to embrace those benefits and foster that innovation. And also at the same time, just be mindful of the safety risks and try to reduce those risks. Again, not to eliminate it, like we're all going to seal ourselves in the basement and have no risk. It's about, you know, mitigating the risk as we foster innovation to achieve good things for society. And that's what this is about.
And I would add that's also what citizens want. So there's been various polls in California and the US across many different countries, and they'll come down to like 70-80% of people want governments to get involved to make sure that we do develop AI in a safe way, that governments get involved to do that. And so it's just common sense. We've done it for pretty much every sector of our societies. You know, your sandwich has more regulation than AI. And of course, it's been incredibly useful to have these kinds of safety-minded legislations for things like aviation, where the accident rate was much, much larger at some point, and putting pressure for companies to prepare plans and mitigations and so on has worked incredibly well in this case. Anytime you have corporations building things that would have drastic positive and negative impact. You know, there's a duty that we set the rules to make sure everyone plays in a safe way.
And I will just add that I think the only part of the bill that is quite non-controversial is what we call CalCompute. It sets up a new public compute cluster, hopefully at the University of California, that'll be sort of a public-private partnership to, first of all, democratize access to compute and to foster responsible innovation.
Nice, nice. Well, finally, Scott, remind me, where is the bill in process in the Senate or the Assembly and the governor's desk?
Yeah, so the bill in May passed the state Senate with 32 votes, so an 80% vote in the Senate. Mm. It has passed both of its Assembly policy committees. That's the Judiciary Committee and the Privacy Committee with very strong votes. It's currently in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. And if that goes well on August 15th, that's the do or die date in that committee, it would be voted on by the full Assembly sometime in late August. The deadline is August 31st at midnight. And then it would go to the governor. The governor has not stated his position. He has made some public comments about understanding the importance of smart regulation and also making sure we don't go too far in terms of wanting to support innovation. So he has not stated a position, and we hope that at some point the governor will provide us with feedback.
Hmm. On the point of amendment, what is the amendment process like? Can you add amendments at every stage along the way, or does that bring you back to square one with respect to all these votes that have already occurred?
Yeah, so we can add amendments up until 72 hours before the end of the legislative session, but the deeper you get into the process, the more complicated it is because you have to go back and try and get buy-in from previous committees that have passed the bill. So for example, Anthropic submitted these requested amendments, and we don't agree with all of the amendments that they've requested, but a number of them, quite a few of them, we think are reasonable or we can at least work with. But we are now in conversation with the committees that have previously passed the bill. So early in the process, as the author, I have very, very broad control over the bill. This deep in, I have to get buy-in from other decision makers as well.
Nice. Well, I want to thank you both for doing your part to rein in our robot overlords when they come. If they're well-behaved, you will have had a hand in making them that way. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.